Today is gloomy and raw, kind of a rough winter day. Wants to rain, but don't, and we're tired of being shut up in the house. This was the kind of a day Alfred was in his glory on the farm. He would dress warm enough and shoulder his tilachi, grubbin' hoe, call up the dogs and hike to the brush. The dogs were always so willing and happy to go. He would pick out a likely-looking hole under a cactus and a brush heap and patch and chop a path up to it and then start to dig it. By this time, the dogs have become impatient and want him out of the way so they can dig. Pretty soon, they have an opening they can sniff, and if it's inviting, the fun has commenced. The trouble was, Betty would get so excited, she would growl and bite at Jack so he would have to give up to her, and she was unequal to the task. However, they could yell, bark, bite, and dig, and usually rout out something. Rabbits, rattlers, rats, armadillos, sometimes skunks. Once they all got sprayed lightly, and my, but they were a mess. But it never taught them a lesson, and they would go again. Once he found a nice hole in an open field, over on the east side of the farm, where the field sloped down to the lagoon. A little outcropping of caliche made it a good place for a small cave. So he and the dogs dug strenuously, but that caliche made it a bit hard, and they did find out there was something there but that was strange to them. So they went down to the house to get reinforcements from Tonner. And Tonner took along the post hole digger and went to work. They were successful, and were on their way to the house just as I drove up from Alice. They met me with their, "Daddy, Daddy, come quick. We got something and we don't know what it is." And there Tonner had the post hole digger in the air upside down and its blades pinched together to form a trap. The trap was full of grayish fuzz balls. He took his catch up under the aethel where the kids had a little pen that set off the ground and had a top. They opened it up and dumped them out. Now, what did they have? 3 baby badgers. They were wild little things and never did tame down, would eat nothing but meat, and after a time, they took them back to the brush and turned them loose. I think some of the stuff I put in this tape may be a repetition of old letters, but if so, maybe this will stand repeating. Chili poutines have long been a treat to most of us, and we nurture the occasional chili poutine bush that the birds so thoughtfully plant in odd spots. Sometimes the pickings get slim and we have to forage a bit. Usually a source can be found. Jim Smith and I kid each other about this, and once I told him, "Jim, I found some fine bushes." "Where are they?" "Courthouse lawn, north side, close under the trees, are several fine bushes ready to pick." "Fine, we'll go right down and get them." "Now, wait a minute, Jim. Supposing the sheriff and the county judge with the commissioners claim these are their privileges and for us to get out. If they do that, we'll just form a demonstration and demand our rights as tax-paying citizens." Well, it didn't come to that, and we found more than enough for our needs. What to do with them? Tonner comes up with a chili poutine sauce. It's one of those recipes where you throw in everything in the kitchen but the kitchen sink. Turned out real good, too. Just a few days later, Mother came to me crying on my shoulder. Her church was having a taste and tell, and she was supposed to have something to display. We had been unusually busy at the studio, and she just hadn't gotten around to this chore, so she said she'd miss this time. I retorted, "Chicken," and she wanted to know what I meant by that. "Well, you got something I'll bet none of them ever tasted." "What's that?" "Why, your chili poutine sauce." "Oh, no. Everybody else will have something sweet and sugary." "Sure, and you'll have something different." We argued for quite a time, and she finally gave up. "How'll I handle it?" Of course I knew, for I had never been to one of these shindigs. "How can they say... sample a hot sauce, get cold boiled ham, cut it into squares about 1 inch. How many?" "Oh, 40 pieces, and you'll probably bring some of them back home." "Okay, you type up a few of the recipes, So she gathered up the stuff and took off to the church. There it was. She was a little late, and everybody else had already spread out their wares. She was appointed an area near the end of the line, and regretfully, she would have liked to have backed out. But she made her display, and a couple of the girls came by and asked her what she had. And when she answered, they replied, "How interesting." But pretty soon, one of the few men came by and asked her the same question. "Never heard of it. Got any samples?" "That's good. Don't run away. I want to go get Bill." Bill came, and the performance was repeated. And in a few minutes, she had all the available men there gathered around her display, and they stayed there and chatted and ate up her samples. All of them stayed there and just chewed the fat. They didn't leave. One of the men had a happy idea. "Hold everything. I'll be right back." He returned with a huge sack of Fritos, and the party started all over again. The Fritos served the purpose very well. Her display was never deserted the whole evening. One woman came to her after it was over and congratulated her, adding that her husband had sure enjoyed her sauce and the gathering around it. He hadn't wanted to come either. Also, she asked for the recipe. This made your mother feel better about the evening and gave the lady what was left in her jar, a little less than half a quart jar. Her thanks were effusive, and she said this would make the day for she and her husband. This is another repetition, I think. I wrote asking whether anyone knew anything about the photo of Buffalo Bill, or if you would rather, the Honorable Colonel William F. Cody. As a young man, Dad had made this picture, and now we can't find it. It was just a small print mounted on a card about 3 by 5 inches. I wanted it to illustrate this story. Few of you realize to the extent that Dad was an entrepreneur. All through his life, till his latter years, he was always mixed up in the art of presenting entertainments. Even as a young man, he sponsored dances, hired the hall, the music, and often some other attraction. What I'm mentioning now was a dance he held in Pella, Iowa, during his younger days. He told me about this years ago, and I think this was before he married. The dance was at night, of course, and in summertime, in a building, upstairs, in the downtown section. The hall was crowded, for the added attraction was a demonstration by Buffalo Bill on roller skates, swinging around the hall, and as he passed the open windows, helpers would cast targets in front of the windows. He would draw his pistol and shoot, breaking the targets through the windows. It was a wonderful demonstration, and he never missed. But one skeptic went up to the windows and on examination found some fine shot embedded in the woodwork. Cody didn't deny the bird shot. Instead, he suggested this man and any friends he cared to invite should show up on a road at the edge of town the next morning, early. Impossible to use roller skates, but he would repeat the performance, and this man would be given the opportunity to inspect his guns and ammunition. It would all be solid shot. At 8 o'clock the next morning, the crowd was there. The performance repeated, and not one miss. After it was over, Cody went up to his objector and asked if he was satisfied. Then he added, "My friend, had you ever considered how many townspeople I could have killed by using solid shot out through those windows?" Then he quietly walked away. One summer, Alan Evans asked me to go with him up to the Nueces River and pick up wild grapes. He wanted to make a keg of grape wine. He had the keg and wanted to set it in one of our sheds for safekeeping, and he would do all the work after we get the grapes. So we got the grapes and did the rest, setting the keg upright on a low box out in our open feed shed. It sat there quite a while, but he always reported it was coming along fine. But one evening, as Mother and I drove in from town, the boys came running to meet us and yelled, "Daddy, Daddy, you better come quick. That wine is fizzing and getting ready to blow up." All it was a big rattler under the box the keg sat on, and he was a warning in a very quiet way that he objected to so much running into that feed shed. All he was there for was to eat all those rats and mice that overran the place, and we had to admit he had been doing an excellent job. But for safety reasons, we got rid of the rattler. Here's another one of Irene's songs. On a Saturday, hurry up, Joe, come to see if Miss Kate would go to see the show. But Miss Kate said no, but I'll tell you what you can do. You can take me out to the ball game, take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks, and I don't care if we never come back. We will root for the home team, and if they don't win, it'll shame. Oh, it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out in the old ball game. One time, it snowed real good, and all the roads were in fine shape for sleighing. I hit on a new trick. That would put more gray hairs in our parents' heads. I tied Charlie's tugs tight behind his rump, then run a rope from those tugs behind him for some 15 feet and attached the far end of the rope to my small coasting sled. Then I took a rope clothesline and pieced out the harness lines so I could drive him seated on my sled behind him full length of the rope. Esther and Ariel said that was fine, hitched on behind me, and as we went around the neighborhood, we soon accumulated a nice long train. We had a lot of fun. Old Charlie didn't seem to mind, even though I think he knew this wasn't kosher. Later, Dad was remonstrating with me and asked me what would we do if our sleds got to going too fast and ran into Charlie's heels. Well, but we had that argument licked. We didn't go where it was very hilly, which was hard to do. Also, pull Charlie out of the line of travel. And lastly, our clincher. Everybody had to learn to drag his feet for breaks. In the summer months, most horses were left unshod. Remember, there were no paved roads or streets. They did oil city streets of later years, but that was to keep down dust. When winter came and the ground froze and you had to shoe horses that were used to traveling over the frozen roads and streets. So we kept Charlie well shod during the winter. It fell to my lot to take him to the blacksmith shop each time for these new shoes. The first time it was a little difficult. He refused to let me lead him into the shop. Evidently, he had been abused in some shop and he knew where he was going. A hand at the shop picked up a whip and started to pop Charlie and drive him in. Kid though I was, I stopped him and told him before we would allow that, we would give up the shoeing. We never whipped him. The boss, who I knew, came out and wanted to know what the trouble was, so he pushed on Charlie's rump, and I pulled, and we got him inside the door. Then Charlie gave up and walked over to his spot with no more coaxing. You know how a horseshoer works. He puts his work case right near the horse's foot, where he intends to work. Then he turns his back to the horse and wrestles the horse's foot, lifting it up and holding it between his knees. They expected trouble with Charlie, but Charlie fooled them. When the man shoved his work case over to Charlie's hind leg, Charlie balanced himself on three legs and lifted that foot up and bent it into position for the man to work. He repeated it for each foot, and they all marveled over his cooperation. He would express his reluctance to enter at each later visit, but always he would cooperate, and certainly there was never any suggestions of using a whip to convince him anymore. Every town, even small towns like Mount Pulaski, had an opera house. Notice I said opera house. Especially through the winter months, traveling troops would come through and give their shows. I got to see practically every show that came to town. Different shows would need furniture and other bits of scenery and so forth, and Lobrich's studio was the closest and the best place to find them. So we had plenty of Annie Oakley's. True, these were usually only for the nigger heaven, but I never sat there. I always went down front row, dead center, where I could see and hear everything. Nobody ever sat there, so I was never chased off. Besides, if they did do that, they probably wouldn't get those chairs the next time. Also, during the winter, there was generally given a minstrel show or two. I always got to see them also, for I usually was in the minstrel part, singing in the chorus. The whole choir I was in was usually there. Then for the oleo, which we had never seen, we could remove our black faces and come out front and watch the rest of it. About once a year, the town would produce an operetta, adults around town taking the main parts, and the high school making up the bit parts and the choruses. Frequently, Dad would star with his basso voice. And in the summertime, they removed the seats in this opera house and held many dances there. There were many windows to the south, and it was cool. You will recall the chicken house under the Athel, south of our house on the farm. Dad had some nests built up along its west wall, about waist high. This height was real convenient when gathering the eggs. But one day, Mother went out there to gather the eggs, and without any first inspection, reached in for the eggs, and to her horror, felt something cold and clammy. Scared, she ran into the house and grabbed the shotgun, went back out and stuck the gun barrel up against that snake's head and pulled the trigger. Since this was only about 6 inches or so from the wall of the shed, she not only blew the snake's head off, but also made a nice, neat, round hole in the sheet metal on the shed wall. You boys kidded her about providing a window so the hen could stick her head out and see what was going on in the world while she was laying her eggs. The snake was a harmless bull snake, about 5 feet long, but if he had been allowed to stay there, no telling how many eggs he would have gathered. Rattlers were quite common, and on great occasion we would kill a coral snake. These latter were rare. A small snake, rarely as much as 3 feet long, beautiful, and very, very poisonous. A night prowler, while he was extremely poisonous, it was difficult for him to harm a human or a large animal. Couldn't open his mouth wide enough to strike a large surface like a hand or a leg and so forth. Very brightly colored in bands of red, black, and yellow. On July 4, we always went to Falfurrias for the big rodeo and barbecue. The earlier days, the whole celebration was free to the whole public, and everyone was there. The King Ranch entered into the celebration in a big way and furnished the beef for the barbecue and horses for the rodeo. Probably some of the performers. Those were the days. The American Legion was represented and, of course, took part. Park Stubblefield was active in the Legion and even pressed me into service a couple of times. Mine was a very minor service. Usually I was one who laded out the lemonade to those who came after it. They had it made up in 50-gallon barrels. Plenty and not too much of a job. Ice cream was a frequent treat on the farm. With plenty of milk and eggs to start on, the only trouble was the ice and the sugar, so you enjoyed ice cream quite often. I've seen you kids put on extra clothes and sit out in the sun so you could get warm enough to eat an extra bowl of ice cream. It sure was good. Alfred, I don't recall my first movie. I do recall the first colored movie ever made. I saw this in Chicago, and I'm not sure of the year, but would guess about 1913 or 14. The title was The Scarlet Letter, and from my remembrance of it, it was a long way short of color today. The big green jaybirds have not returned this year, not in numbers. We do have one stray couple that have stayed through the winter, but they are shy and seldom come out past the brush patch west of the house. I feed them peanuts in the shell and suet. They come back each day for just a short time and clean it up. We have had ripe tomatoes all through this winter. Gerard planted them early last fall in 5-gallon cans. They set on the south side of the house in full sunshine. When the temperature drops below freezing, either he or Tonner carry them back into the garage and then out again when the warmer temperatures are back. Alfred, in looking over your notes, I wonder if I haven't missed some. You ask how we bought and stored fuel and about preservation of meats, fruits, and so forth. I don't think I covered all of that. First, the fuels. Until we came to Texas, fuel meant coal. In the north, practically every house I ever knew anything about had a cellar underneath it, and at the back of the lot was a coal shed. In the older homes, the cellars did not always encompass the whole area under the house, but in later houses, the cellars usually went under the whole area. where there was a furnace in the cellar, with the coal was also stored there. This was the way it was in Carlinville. There we had the old kitchen range and a furnace down in the cellar. Both were rigged up to the hot water tank. In the winter, we always had more hot water than we needed from the furnace, but in warm weather, we had to fire up the old cook stove, which speedily gave us hot water for our shower baths and the family washing. The family washing the first years, everyone did the same. Soaked the worst things overnight, then washed them on a washboard and a tin tub. This was work. In Mount Pulaski, all the years we lived there, we had our laundry done by a wash lady. Her name was Mrs. Level, and it cost us 75 cents a week to do the family's washing. This was another job of mine, taking the family wash packed into a big wicker basket across town and back each week. With the advent of Charlie, the horse, it wasn't so much of a chore. Then when we lost the washing lady, we got a washing machine, a wooden tub on legs, and the power furnished by someone turning a wheel on its side. This was hard. Then they brought one out with a heavy flywheel underneath the tub, powered by a lever that you pushed back and forth. Also, the lower end of the lever had a foot pedal. Worked easily using both foot and hand together, but not so good using just foot pedal. We had that washer several years until we got the hot water and electricity in the cellar, and then we got an electric washer. Back to the farm at first, it was the old tin tub and the washboard, till we got the air motor, and with electricity we added an electric washer in the wash house. I can't remember my first use of a telephone. I do recall that you had to ring central by turning a little handle on the side of the telephone, and in the earlier days you didn't bother with numbers but asked for the person that you wanted. Those central girls were smart and quickly knew their subscribers. Central, even in a little town like Mount Pulaski, had to have several office girls working and even had night shifts. Here in Alice, the central office was right across the hall from my studio entrance. They had a lot of girls, and of course I soon knew them all. The only public pay end of the only public pay station was at the end of this hall, about 8 or 10 feet down at the end of the hall past my door. The stairway was right near my door. And in warm weather, I could leave my door open and get the most wonderful cool draft coming up that stairway through my door and studio and out through the window below the skylight. One night, I was retouching late and moved my desk up near the front to enjoy the breeze fully. I wasn't intending to eavesdrop, but a big buck nigger came up to this pay station and called his girlfriend in Houston. He soon ran out of conversation material and wound up asking her the question, did she still love him? She must have been loath to answer because he repeated and begged an answer for about a half an hour until she gave him a regretful yes. Not being satisfied, he then asked her, how come you do? Now this was a poser, and in another 30 minutes he failed to get an answer. So he finally gave up and told her, I know how come you do. Evidently, she asked him the answer, and he replied, because you don't know no better. I was talking earlier about working in a grocery store, and I got to thinking of the great difference in stores of that day and these modern supermarkets. In those days, you were waited on by a clerk, and you told him what you wanted, and he produced it. He stayed in the aisles behind the counter, and you stood out in front. So much stuff was not packaged as it is today. Crackers and the ordinary cookies, such as ginger snaps and so forth, were shipped out in barrels. And you bought them in a paper sack by the pound. The fancy cookies were displayed in returnable tin cans with glass lids and in a rack. These, too, you bought by the pound. Eggs were in a 30-dozen crate, and they were delivered to you in a sack. After they went over the counter, any breakage was yours. Potatoes were not sold by the pound, but by the half peck or bushel. They were measured by a round form that held the exact amount and was slid into the sack, filled, and the form slid out. Butter was kept in the ice box, and you had your choice, usually, of buying a molded pound or buying any amount off of a big dish of loose butter. If you were in the in crowd, you might be allowed to smell the butter before you bought it. Those in the know had a standing order, often from a certain farmer, and it had to be A1. I got a letter from Ariel today, and she reminded me of another story about old Charlie the horse. When she finished high school, she went to college and took the necessary courses to fit her to be a teacher. Her first job was a country school several miles east of town. Most of the time, she lived with a family named Foley, friends of our parents. Usually, late Sunday evening, we would drive her out there and then go after her after school hours on a Friday. I don't know what the change in plans was caused by, but one time she had to be back at home for the evening and there were complications. A spring thaw was in progress and the roads were impassable. Only one way to travel by horseback, so we put the saddle on the old Charlie and she rode him to her school. This wasn't too bad. Charlie wasn't a saddle animal and didn't have a very smooth gait when he went faster than a walk, but she got there okay. Coming home, she got started out all right, but she made one mistake. At first, Charlie didn't know what apples were, but we kids soon educated him, and when using him, it was the practice to stop wherever you were and feed him the core when you ate an apple. He thought this was a very satisfactory arrangement, and after Ariel had gone a good distance on her slow trek back home, she drew an apple out of her pocket and proceeded to enjoy it. Now, Charlie was aware of this, but she didn't realize this, and when she finished the apple, thoughtlessly, she cast the core away. Now, that was a faux pas. Charlie stopped and edged over into the ditch, headed back to school. Refused to go any other direction, and she couldn't make him go. Wound up by her going all the way back to the schoolhouse, where she got another apple, which she fed him, and then started home again. This time, he took her straight home with no argument. She ate no more apples. How many of you remember Ruth's teaching Charlie the art of eating a piece of hard stick candy? When we got him, I don't think Charlie had ever tasted sugar. Ruth broke off a piece of hard candy, and he was uninterested. She forced it into his mouth and then held his lips shut. He thought he was being abused. She gave up and left him alone. Later, tried to put a bridle on him, and he just wouldn't open his mouth. She finally forced the bit between his teeth, and out slipped a sliver of that candy. He had been sucking on it all that time, just found out what it was good for. She picked it up, washed it in a water trough, and gave it back to him to finish. After that, he would eat candy and even lap up granulated sugar from your hand, but that was a messy, slobbery deal.